I want to thank Michael and Marsha Lacks and Ian and Pam Rosmarin again, for those who weren't here in the original lecture, for their sponsorship. And I want to thank Rabbi Silber for joining us over Shabbos, and who will, he's really a wonderful teacher. And, you know, Matty alluded to it, but in his introduction to his book, he got inspired into the study of Tanakh. Rabbi Silber used to give a shiur in Lincoln Square Synagogue, I believe in the 70s on Shabbos morning before davening, and open up the eyes. And really, I've heard him a few times now. He was here last year, this year. Every time he speaks, it's quite illuminating. His literary analysis of Tanakh, his insights, it's really a pleasure to hear. So he's going to speak now on Purim Torah humor, the use of humor. Just to mention, he's the founder of Trisha Institute, which is really the first high-level women's learning place came out in the world. He founded it in the 70s on the west side of Manhattan. He is the father of 8 children, perhaps even more important, it's a pleasure to have him here, and I don't know where he is. He was here a minute ago. Oh, there you are. Okay, I'm sorry. I hope I did the introduction okay. And he lives a little... I'm sorry. Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Good to be here. Good morning, everybody. Okay, so the topic is, I guess, humor in the Bible, I guess, is the topic. And I suppose when we think of the Bible, I guess the first thing that comes to mind is not that it's a very funny book, but really the question is, there are a few stories in the Bible that have quite a humorous side to them. So I thought I'd identify 2 of them this morning. One, of course, is the Megillah. And then to make some observations about humor and its and the function of humor specifically in Megillat Esther. So I think we'll begin with the Megillah. And what are the elements of humor that we find in the Megillah? So the Megillah begins, of course, with the first chapter with 2 parties. Hope everybody has a copy of the Megillah. The first party, we are told, lasts a total of 180 days. That's half a year. It's a party for half a year. In the words of the Megillah, Yamim Rabim, Shmonim U'ma'at Yom, is chapter 1. And after the completion of that party, the Megillah begins with an elaborate description of the parties, which itself is very interesting. And then, at the end of this party, there's another party. And this party lasts 7 days. In the second party, this is a party for the people that, in the words of the Megillah, Kol Ama Nimtzim B'Shushana Bira L'Migadol V'Ad Katan. This party, again, is described. The furnishings of the party, quite elaborate, the silver, the gold, etc. And then we're told as well there's a second party going on at the same time. Queen Vashti has another party. She has a party for the women in the castle, in the palace of the king. That's how this book begins. It's very important how books begin. Interesting is that the sort of objective description of these parties, the first party is Yamim Rabim. In terms of the second party, we are told, V'yein malchut rav ki yad ha-melech. And furthermore, in the following verse, in verse number 8, the king has so commanded, I'll get to it in a second, hashdiyah, concerning the drinking, hashdiyah kadat ein ones. It's a curious phrase. The drinking was according to the law. And what is the law? Ein ones, which means you can do whatever you want. There's a law at the party. There's a law throughout the book. First law is very instructive. The law is do whatever you want, but it's a law. Kichein tzivah ha-melech, and this was commanded by the king, al-kol rav beito, and the many members of his household, la'asot chitzon ish, you can do whatever you want. Until a couple of verses later, when Queen Vashti doesn't want to appear at his drunken party, then she can't do whatever she wants. But what's interesting is, before we get to the point about the parties, I want to mention something else, that the Megillah, in the very beginning, there's a little word that appears 3 times. And the word is Rav, many or great. The party is Yomim Rabim. The king commands Kol Rav Beito. And Shtiya is Rav. That's how the book begins. So it strikes me that the Megillah is actually alluding to something else, which is very central to the kind of humor it employs. The person, the book begins and ends, this Megillah begins and ends with King Ahasuerus. That's the beginning of the book, an elaborate description of HaMelech. And the end of the book, Vayosem HaMelech Ahasuerus, Masal Aretz V'yeyayam, etc. What does the Torah say about a king? There is in the book of Devarim, Parshat HaMelech, a short little section about what the king should do or may not do. The truth is the Torah never actually tells us what a king does for a living. But it does say what a king shouldn't do. There's one main point in the Chumash about what a king should not do. And the key word is excess. Right? Lo yarbeh. Lo yarbeh susim, lo yarbeh nashim. Kesef is zahav, lo yarbeh lo ma'od. You should have too much gold and silver. So of course the Megillah begins precisely with the violation of every word. The only thing he doesn't violate is bringing the people back to Mitzrayim, but in a sense he doesn't have to, because the Megillah itself, Parasa Madai of the Megillah, is precisely Mitzrayim in terms of values, in terms of what it's about. But in terms of everything else, that's how the book begins, reminding the reader, and not only that, by the way, there's something else the king has to do, you recall. Not just Lo Yarbeh, but there's actually a mitzvah. What is the king supposed to do? The Megillah picks this up and runs with it in spades. What does the king have to do when he has to write a Sefer Torah? And when does he have to write a Sefer Torah, by the way? In the words of the Chumash. Vayakish shifto al kisei malchuto. I thought the Megillah, kishevet hamelech achashverosh al kisei malchuto. Get the sense the writer is actually almost transcribing what it says in the Chumash. When you sit on your throne, the important thing is to write a Sefer Torah, right? In order that you not deviate from, right? Uvilti yorum livavo me'echav. You should not be exceedingly haughty. So on one level, the Achashverosh is a great Democrat. Everybody from the town is invited to his party. But from the other side, clearly, he's hardly a Democrat. Because everything that he does in this book, from beginning to end, has only one function, which is to please the king. Now, that's how the book begins. So the humor, the element of humor over here, apart from the critical point of the difference between perhaps what should be and what is, but the other point that Megillah picks up on is this kind of exaggerated behavior. Okay, he has two parties, but one is 7 days, but the other is 180 days. And this theme of exaggeration, kind of grotesque exaggeration, runs through the entire Megillah. It's true in chapter 1. It's certainly true in chapter 2. In chapter 2, the king has deposed Vashti, who refuses to appear at his party. And of course, as Adele Berlin points out in her commentary on Esther, it's interesting that when Vashti refuses to come to his party wearing the crown, there's immediately the king consults with all his high officials, Chachamim, Yodei Ha'itim, you know, with like major cabinet meetings, emergency midnight meetings. She won't appear. But in chapter 3, when Haman says to the king, there's a lot of people out there in every single one of your 127 states. They have their own laws, don't seem to follow your laws. Let's kill every one of them, men, women, and children. Okay, here's my ring, do whatever you want. I mean, but that's, you know, but when the queen won't appear at his party, that's reason for, you know, the emergency, state of emergency. Now we come to the second chapter. Vashti's been deposed. In the second chapter, we have to replace Vashti. So the king himself does not make a suggestion as to what to do. In the second chapter, the suggestion is made, we are told, by Na'arei HaMelech, the young men of the king's court. It's probably also a dig at the king. We know from the Bible that you have advisors who are old and advisors who are young. So if you listen to the young ones, you're in trouble. You listen. Experience and wisdom are clearly linked in the Bible. Rechavam has his old advisors and his young ones. He disobeys the older ones and he goes with the kids. Big mistake. Here the Na'arei HaMelech make a suggestion. What's the suggestion of the Na'arim? Answer, to bring Na'arot. Yivakshu Lamelech Narot Betulot Tovot Mareh. Gather in all of these women, and the one the king likes the best, she's going to be the next queen. So here we are. You get a sense that this writer is having a great time writing this book, because you have this hilarious idea that, so you have 127 states, which according to the advisors, and the king implements this, the king appoints officials in every state to procure all of these young women. The 127 states, so you can imagine, 127 state offices, which they are sending the women to the king. And these women, who are taken forcibly, by the way, brought to the king, must undergo a beauty treatment. The beauty treatment lasts no less than 12 months in the Megillah. Kedat ha-Nashim Shnei Marsa Chodesh, that's the second instance of a dat. And the Megillah describes this treatment. Shisha Chodeshim B'Shemen Hamar, 6 years cosmetic treatment, and 6 months, Pavasamim, Tamrukei ha-Nashim. And after this 12 months, and the Megillah says, then this treatment is the way it has to be, Kichen Yimlu'u Yimei Merukehen. So we have this process. We know that Esther becomes the queen in the 7th year of his reign. We know that the story of Vashti takes place in the beginning of the 3rd year of his reign. So it means this must be going on, could be going on for 4 years, where they're gathering all the women to the king's palace over the course of many years. Again, a kind of grotesque exaggeration. But what's interesting is that the writer of this kind of dispassionate description of what is happening has, of course, something to say about it. And the way the writer comments about this statement, the contrast between what he does and what should be done, perhaps, is by alluding, as the writer does in at least 50 to 100 places in this book, to the story of Yosef. The Megillah, of course, I can't discuss that now, although this afternoon I will discuss a different aspect of that. But there are many, many, many allusions to the Joseph narrative in the Megillah. One of them is found in, actually more than one, many are found in the second chapter. I'll mention two of them. One is that the gathering of the women to the palace, right? They should all be gathered up. You should appoint officials, gather them, right? And they give it over to Haggai Shomer HaNashim, the watcher, the guardian of the women. All of that language is clearly playing off Joseph's advice to the king. The king should appoint officers and gather in all of the wheat and place it tachat Yad Paro under Pharaoh's control. Over here, Yad Haggai. Ocho Be'arim V'shamaru, the food is to be guarded and washed. Yad Haggai Shomer HaNashim. So the people, the human beings being gathered into the king, are like the bundles of wheat being gathered in. The kind of story which actually is so dehumanizing. And if that's not enough, the Megillah, in describing the beauty treatments, the cosmetics, which take place for 12 months, all according to law, kiken yimru'u yimei merukehen, no less. And of course, the writer has in mind the verse at the end of Genesis, which describes the embalming of Jacob. Kichen yimru'u yimei achanutim, the Torah says about. In other words, like bodies, like dead bodies being embalmed, human beings are being brought into the king. And again, this goes on for years and years. So the Megillah is beginning, the first two chapters. You almost laugh. I mean, laugh because it's bigger than life. 1 year beauty treatments, thousands of women being brought in. Every state has a state office, 180-day parties. And then we come to the next chapter, of course. And there we have a different decree. Haman is very upset that one person doesn't bow down to him. One person doesn't. By the way, remember in the Megillah, he has no idea he's not bowing down. He never notices it. It's not that he sees it. He has no idea. Who knows how long it's going? Mordechai won't bow down for whatever reason. I'm not discussing it, but he doesn't bow down. Haman doesn't know it. But people in the court tell him. First, they speak to Mordechai privately. Why do you violate the king's commands, is what they say. It's clear to them, of course, that the reason the king commands people to bow down to Haman has little to do with Haman. It has to do with the king himself, who was almost assassinated 2 verses earlier. So the king wants to make sure everybody in the court is loyal. So therefore, everybody in the court has to bow down to his little boy, who's Haman. Everybody understands that except for one person who thinks it's about himself, which of course is Haman. So he's terribly offended when he recognizes after they tell him that Mordechai won't bow down, and he insists on killing not just Mordechai, but on killing all the Jews in all the states. So he goes to the king, first having cast the lot to determine the day, and then he goes to the king and he makes his argument that there are people that don't keep your laws, and then Haman adds something else. Baseret alafim kikar kesef eshkol ayidei osei hamlacha. And I will guarantee, he says, 10,000 talents of silver, right, to bring into the king's treasury. I presume that means to pay for it. In other words, the killing will take place. The money is to be laundered, as it were, or to be paid into the treasuries. The treasuries will pay out to the army. The army will kill the Jews. That's my understanding of what he says. The king says, that's fine. Hakesef notunla, which does not mean you can keep your money. It means it's given to you. I give you permission to do it this way. The money, having been brought to the treasury, is yours to do whatever you want. Now, how much exactly is Aseret Alafim Kikar Kesef? How much money, how much could that be? So I'm not an expert in ancient Near Eastern coins, but from what I've read about the amount of money we're talking about, you're talking about an amount of money that probably equals the gross national product of all 127 states. It's a phenomenal sum of money. Aseret Alafim, how much was the whole Mishkan? Was it 1,700 kikar? I remember. The point is, this is not possible. I will give you $2 trillion if to do this. I mean, it's another example of the Megillah of this incredible, everything is exaggerated. Now I'll get to what I will suggest is the purpose of these exaggerations. There's another exaggeration. I'll give you another exaggeration in the Megillah, that for sure. Later on, after Haman comes back from the party, he has another invitation. He goes back home and he's very pleased because he's so important. He says he's so wealthy and he's such a big family and he's so honored and he's the most important person. Not only that, he's the only one the queen invites together with the king. And also tomorrow I'm invited, he says. But you know what? I can't enjoy any of this stuff because there's one guy in the gate who doesn't bow down to me, right? So what was that guy's in the gate? The guy in the gate is Mordechai, who's on death row, essentially. There's one fellow on death row who won't bow down to me. Of course, if I were Mordechai, why would you bow down to him? He's the guy responsible to have you killed. Why would I see, and I'm going to be killed anyway in a few months, why would I honor Haman? Okay, fine. So he says, I can't enjoy my meal tomorrow. So his friends say to him, no problem. Why don't you just go to the king tomorrow? And tell the king to kill Mordechai. Right? Let them build a gallows 50 cubits high. How tall is a gallows 50 cubits high? Let's say a cubit is a foot and a half. That could be more. 75. How many buildings in the ancient Near East were 75 feet high? I can imagine close to zero. How's that possible? 75 feet high. You're talking about eight stories high. In he constructs the gallows. Before, of course, asking the king permission, he does it. He assumes, tells the king what to do. Another exaggeration. So you have this series of these exaggerations. I'll tell you another one that's also probably an exaggeration in the Megillah, is when Esther says to Mordechai in chapter 4, turning point, tell the people to fast with me for 3 days, day and night, not to eat and not to drink. I know you understand that, but can you actually not drink for 3 consecutive days? I think the Gemara discusses that. It's not easy not to drink, not eat or drink for 3 days. And it sounds in the Megillah as if they're 3 consecutive days. The truth is that the Mishnah in Masechet Tanit has fast of three-day fasts, a series of three. But it doesn't sound that way in them. It sounds that actually she's saying don't eat or drink for 3 days. That's virtually impossible. How could that be? No one eats or drinks for 3 days. But again, exaggeration. The Megillah is filled with exaggerations which can't possibly be taken literally, but the writer is pointing in a certain direction. Part of it is the humor. I mean, it's something, the humor is blowing things out of proportion. That's one of the aspects of humor, and particularly humor over here. And in particular, what's interesting is that the humor is directed against primarily either Achashverosh or against Haman. In other words, the humor is directed against the human being who thinks he's other than what he really is, which is just a fallible mortal being. The person who thinks that he is master of the universe, master of the world. In the case of Ahasuerus, we of course can read this book in two very different ways. One way to read the book, though, is that he's simply a fool. That the writer was laughing at this man. This is the king of the world. What a fool he is. Both in terms of Vashti, in terms of the second chapter, he never even asked the question, who are the people I'm going to kill? Doesn't seem to know. So one way to read the book, it's not the only way to read this book, but one way and a totally valid way to read the book is that we're talking about that the book is mocking, laughing at kingship and at kings. In reality, they're no better and probably worse than most people. They're not wise. Decisions are made in this book by others, which they go along with. That's one way to read the Megillah. And I was thinking that actually, in terms of this kind of humor, this kind of poking fun of people who think they're more than they are, that there is another story in the Chumash, and just very briefly, which also has an element of what I would say humor. It's not a story we usually identify as a humorous story. I'll get to the humorous story of the Bible in 1 minute, and then make a couple of comments about it. But there is another story, I think, that has elements of humor. This is a story that appears in the 14th chapter of the book of Bereshit. That's a very important chapter. The 14th chapter of Bereshit describes a battle of five kings against four. It's not a chapter that jumps to mind when you pick out what are the 10 most important chapters of the Bible or something, greatest hits. It's not a chapter that you think of automatically, but it actually is a very important chapter in the Chumash and in our tradition. The chapter describes a war of five kings against four. The five kings, and it says, it came to pass, right? Vayhibi mei Amraphel melech Shinar. It came to pass in the days of Amraphel, the king of Shinar, which is Babylon, that there was a war. Who's on either side of the war? So it says, in the days of Amraphel, right? In the days of Amraphel, the king of Shinar. And then the Torah lists the names of the kings. Torah says, in the days of these kings, starting with the king of Shinar, they had a war against five kings. Bera, the king of Sodom, Bisha, Melech Amorah, Shinav, Melech Admah, Shemev, Melech Tzvoyim, Melech Bela, Hitzoah. So this is the war. Then the Torah describes how this came to pass. They gathered together in Emek HaSidim, which is the Dead Sea. For 12 years they served Kedola Omer, in the 13th year they rebelled. In the 14th year Kedomer came down, and the kings that were with him. And they defeated the Rephaim, and they defeated the Zuzim, and defeated the Amim, and the Chori. And they came, returned to Ein Mishpat, and they defeated, and they destroyed the fields of Amalek, and they defeated the Emori. And then the king of Sodom and Amorah and the other three went out, and they fought a war in Emek HaSidim, and it was with Kedola Omer and Tidal and Amraphel and Arioch, four kings against five. Let me ask you, who has the advantage now? Who do you think is going to win the war? Kedola Omer or the king of Sodom? What does the Chumash suggest to us? When you read it, what do you think? Most people say what? What do you think? What do you think? What? Which ones? Of course, the five. Why? Because five are more than four. Isn't that right? Of course, that is preposterous, isn't it? It's ridiculous. The four are the four great nations of the world, beginning with Shinar. The five are tiny little kinglets along the Dead Sea. What do you mean four against? It's like saying you have Russia and China, United States against what? Against four, five little townlets, hamlets somewhere, who knows? What? You mean four against five? Of course, the reason you say that, the Chumash sets us up. It's four against five, the Chumash says. By the way, from the first words of the chapter, you know, that can't be true. It came to pass in the days of Amraphel. You wouldn't say it came to pass in the days of the king of Sodom. You might say it came to pass in the days of Alexander the Great. What do you mean it came to the days of... Shinar is Babel. Shinar is Migdal Babel. Shinar is the great metropolis. Together with the others. Elam. These are giant nations. Sodom, Amorah. They're tiny. And the truth of the matter is the way the Chumash sets it up, the great battle of the five kings against the four. But when you read it carefully, what you discover is that the battle in the story, there is a great battle, but it's not five kings against the four. It's the four kings against the nations they fight. Rephaim, Amim, Zuzim, Amori, Amalek. In fact, the list of people they defeat, this is very important, is virtually identical to the list that's found in the first chapter of Sefer Dvarim. When the Chumash says, don't start up with Esav, don't start up with Ammon and Moab, because I have dispossessed the giants from before them, which is a sign that it must be God, because otherwise how can you possibly defeat Rephaim, or Amim, or Zuzim? It's not possible. Therefore it must be the hand of God. When you read the chapter and reread the chapter, it's clear. There actually is no war between the five kings and the four. What does it say? The five kings never fight the four. They can't fight them. But what does it say? The four kings are returning, having defeated all the peoples of Canaan. One might say symbolically possessing the land of Canaan. The five kings, now they're going back home, and they're walking back north. They went south, they're walking north. The Emek HaSidim, and now we have the great battle. The Emek HaSidim, Be'erod, Be'erod, Chemar. There are many slime pits in the valley of Sidim. Vayanusu Melech, Sodom v'Amorah v'yiplu shama. And the king of Sodom and Amorah fell there. There's a pun on the word to fall. In Hebrew and in English, to fall in battle. But here they didn't fall in battle on the battlefield. Here they fall into the slime pits. And therefore, what happened? Vayikhu et kol rechush Sodom v'Amorah v'yet kol achron v'yelechu. Vayikhu et lot v'yet rechusho b'nachi avron v'yelechu. You see the picture? They're walking home. There's a little mosquitoes over here, the slime pits. Oh, so we'll take the people. They're walking. They're not fighting. They're walking home. There's no battle whatsoever. There couldn't possibly be a battle between these kings and the five little nobodies. How could there be? But the Chumash sets up this dissonance between what actually must be the case, which is the case when you read it, but it sets up a false expectation, the five kings against the four. And then, of course, at the end of the story, we have the king of Sodom coming out to greet Abraham. And where does he greet him, by the way, in the story? He fell into Emek HaSidim, the slime pits. So where does he come to greet him in this parasha? Emek Shaveh. What is Emek Shaveh? It means a flat land, flat. Shaveh is flat. He wants to make sure he doesn't fall into the pit again. So he comes out to greet Abraham at the end of Emek Shaveh. We saw he makes demands, no less. The arrogance of this little petty nobody. What's interesting is, but you see the humor over here. I mean, I guess you didn't think it was that funny. I think it's very funny. It's a very funny story. But it's the same kind of humor. It's directed essentially against the king. That is to say, against the human being who would think that he or she is more than a human being with all our limitations and failings. That's what the Chumash is at. That's what it's about. And I'll give another small example of this and come to the main point. The Tower of Babel. There you have it. We're going to build a tower up to heaven, right? A city and a tower to heaven. V'naseh lanu shem, and make a great name for ourselves. And the next verse, V'yered Hashem l'rot et ha-migdol, right? But God went down to see the city. We're going to build a tower to heaven, right? Make a great name for ourselves. God went down, said, what is this? What do they think they're doing? Right? We want to make a name for ourselves, right? And God says, I see trouble over here. So the Chumash, if you read Migdal Babel, 9 verses, count the word umisham. Umisham hefitzam Hashem. Sham, misham, misham. Place on. You want to make a name, but from that very place, I disperse you. Pen no food, so that's why we dispersed. That's why you dispersed. It's the same thing. It's the arrogant person who thinks that, in this case of Babel, that they are more than just human. They want to be God. They want to be great. We want to make a name for ourselves. And the Chumash says, that's not how you make a name. God confers the name and makes demands. It's Abraham. Agadu Hashemecha. Actually, the story after Migdal Babel is the story of it. It's the next story, actually, if you think about it. It's actually the next story. Anyway, let me get back to the main point I want to make over here about biblical humor. There is one story in the Chumash we could all agree is one funny story in the Torah. One actually funny story in the whole Chumash, which is clearly intended to be a funny story in the Torah. The Megillah has comic elements, But there's one bit, one story of humor in the Torah. And the one story, if it was which one? Of course. The story of Bilam and Balak is the one story that clearly is intended to have a humorous side to it. There, what's very interesting is, what are the elements of humor in the Bilam story? I'll mention a couple of them. One is, of course, the very idea of a prophet that you're going to hire. Balak contacts Bilam, says, I want you to come because I know whoever you bless is blessed, whoever you curse is cursed. So that's the very concept of a prophet that you pay. And by the way, the idea of being paid to work runs through the whole story. Bilam says on more than one occasion, no matter how much money you pay me, I can't do it. Someone who talks in those terms is, you know, what's he thinking? As Rashi points out, not what you pay me. So that's the first point. Then he travels along. He insists on going. God says, don't go. But he insists on going. Then, of course, we have the scene of the talking aton. Now, that is actually a very interesting scene for several reasons. First of all, the standing in front of Bilam, he doesn't see it, is an angel with a sword. Charbo shufa biyado. Of course, the aton, the animal, sees the angel with the sword, but Bilam can't see it. The great prophet can't see it, but this ass sees it. That's the first point. And then, of course, the aton tries to avoid the sword. So keeps moving off the path. On three separate occasions, Bilam hits the aton. After the third time, the animal opens up his or her mouth, I don't know, and says to Bilam, why have you hit me these three times? Why have you hikitani zesh shalosh regalim? Why have you hit me these three times? And Bilam answers. Bilam talks back. Because you're making fun of me. Ki hitalav bi. Because you're mocking me. Lu yesh cherev biyadi ki ata haragtich. If I had a sword in my hand, I would kill you. Which is funny for two reasons. First of all, they're very engaging in the conversation. It's pretty funny. But apart from that, if I had a sword in my hand, I would kill you, is precisely the reason that she veers off the path. Because the charbo shufa biyado, the angel has a sword in his hand. But the other point is, what do you mean if I have a sword in my hand, I'm going to kill you? The man has been hired to destroy a nation by cursing them. Why does he need to have a sword? Can he just curse the animal and kill the animal? He needs a sword? But actually, there's a deeper point about the aton, which is very interesting. The Chumash emphasizes, it's interesting, that's the only other place outside of Aliyah L'Regel, the pilgrimage, where you have the term in the Torah, Shalosh Regalim. And it appears three times. It's not an accident. If I have time, I'll get back to that. But the point is, on three separate occasions, Bilam hits the animal, because Bilam doesn't see. The animal sees, Bilam doesn't see. Because people don't understand what you're doing, they criticize. They have no understanding, usually. They're criticizing. If they understood, they wouldn't criticize so much. They don't understand. Point is, in the next story, afterwards, Bilam says, maybe I should go home. Or, don't go home. You do what I tell you to do. So Bilam proceeds. And then you have three blessings of Israel by Bilam. After each of the three blessings, he's criticized by his employer, Balak. Each time he criticizes, what are you doing? Hide your curse. What are you blessing it for? What can I do? I can't help it. In other words, one might say in the next sequence of stories, Bilam stands in for the aton, and Balak stands in for Bilam. So the aton story is actually very interesting because, in a sense, Bilam is the aton in the very next story. Now, the great prophet. His prophecy, of course, ends with the words, those who bless you are blessed, O Israel. Those who curse you are cursed, which, of course, exactly contradicts the initial statement in the story that I'll pay you to curse them because whoever you curse is cursed. But then there's another aspect of the story. What happens next in the Bilam story? And this is another interesting piece of humor. The one who picked up on this was Sigmund Freud, actually. Not about Bilam, but he makes a very important point. This is Freud's take on humor. Very, very good. Jokes and the Relationship to the Unconscious is a very important book. See, what happens afterwards, Bilam says to Balak, Balak says to Bilam, what can I do? I wanted to honor you. I wanted to give you kavod, but God has taken away your honor. What can I do? So run home, he says. Brach, bet, resh, chet. as opposed to Bet Resh Chaf, which is to bless. Brachlecha Mekol Mecha. I thought we could honor you with no honor. So Bilam says, okay, what can I do? But I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Before I leave, I'll give you let me tell you something else. What's going to happen to your people at the end of days? This one's for free. It's on the house, he says. This one's on the house. And then he proceeds to tell him terrible things. Umachatz Pate Moav. He talks about Moav, destruction of Moav. He mentions Amalek, which I'll come back to in a couple of minutes. What is that about? There's something very interesting about the Bilam story, which is the following. If you read it carefully, the first two times Bilam wants to curse the Jews, he's seeking out a place to curse them. The third time he curses them, or doesn't curse them, but wants to curse them, was hired to curse them. The Torah says, at this time, v'lo halach kifayar Bilam, ki tov b'yenei Hashem livarech et Yisrael. Bilam understood that God wanted to bless Israel. V'lo halach kifam b'fam likrat nechashim. He didn't seek out nechashim, the third divination, the third time. V'yosem el hamidbar panav. And you have a sense in the Bilam story. You know, Freud has a book about jokes. So he has two kinds of jokes. It's very interesting. They're all Jewish jokes. He has two kinds. Either about shadchanim, it's one kind of joke, or about wealthy people and poor people. Those are his two jokes. So I'll give you one example of one of the jokes. And Freud explains the joke. And that's exactly the story of Bilam, the way the Chumash presents it in Bamidbar. He has one joke that the shadchan is taking the prospective groom to the house of the prospective bride. So he brings the groom has never met the bride, of course. It's a setup. So he'll meet the bride, he'll see the family, and he'll decide to marry her. So he walks into this house. It's gorgeous. It's a beautiful house. And in the front is a brick front with all kinds of silver cups in it and gold. It's unbelievable. So the shadchan turns to the groom, who seems to have a frown. He says, look at the wealth of these people. So the groom says, it is very beautiful. Let me ask you a question. How do I know all this stuff actually belongs to them? Maybe they just borrowed it for the occasion. At which point the shadchan says, are you kidding? Who would give these bums anything? Now, why is that a funny joke? That's how Freud analyzes the joke. Here's his analysis, which I think is very, very sharp. He says, what is a shadchan? A shadchan is a person who basically lies for a living. He has to, everything is wonderful, but the shadchan actually resents it. Because people want to tell the truth. But the first opportunity to tell the truth he seizes upon, the moment he sees it's not going anywhere, he's happy to heap on the abuse. That's exactly the story of Bilam. Bilam is hired to curse his job. That's how he makes a living. He blesses and he curses, okay? And he gets paid a big fee for it too, apparently. But as the story proceeds, he begins to note that God actually doesn't want to curse them. It's not going to work. And the moment it's not going to work, part of him actually wants to bless. And then he gets fired, and he actually wants to bless. So he insists on telling the truth even after he's fired. Go home. No, I don't want to go yet. Let me tell you something else I didn't tell you yet. There's something very funny about that, you know. So it's the dissonance between, in Freud's words, the impositions of society, of religion, society, whatever. On the other hand, what people really think. That's his jokes. He has many wonderful jokes about the rich and the poor. Terrific jokes, actually. But not for now. But in the Megillah, I'm wondering whether, how much time do I have here, by the way? 20 minutes, okay. Let me make two points about this, which is actually something to think about, which is actually very important. And that is, here's what I wonder about. Anybody who's actually studied the Megillah knows that it's an unbelievable. I'm actually working on the Megillah right now. It's mind-boggling. There's so much here. But one of the things the Megillah does is to allude to other biblical stories. I mentioned the Joseph story, which it alludes to, and I'll talk about this afternoon in many, many ways, very interesting ways. Not only does it allude to it, it actually interprets it in a certain sense as well. So there are many, many allusions to various stories. What I wondered about is whether you have these two, within our tradition, There are two funny stories in the Bible. There may be a couple of others, but the two that stand out are the story of Bilam and Megillat Esther. And what I wonder about is there a connection between these two stories, beyond the humor? Is there actually something else? Is there a reason? Because you could have written the Megillah in a different way. The writer chooses to write a certain way. He's choosing to write a story which can be read as which has comical elements, which is not to say that it's not serious. It's dead serious. But it has a comical side to it. Are there other connections to the Bilam story besides? I began to wonder about that. And it strikes me that the story of Bilam probably has relevance to the Megillah. For the following reason. The story of Bilam, and let me make a difference before I get to the Megillah. The story of Bilam is actually clearly in that tradition one of the foundational stories of the Jewish tradition. Statement in the Gemara, Moses wrote his book in the book of Bilam, or the Yerushalmi, that they thought of including in the Kriyat Shema, Parshat Balak, in the Shema. They considered that possibility, the Ten Commandments, Shema, and Bilam. There's something about Bilam that's very significant. What is the serious side of the Bilam story? We understand it's a joke. What is it, a comic intro? It's the longest narrative in the book of Bamidbar. What's it about, actually? Why is it important? It's important because it comes at a very important moment in the book. It comes exactly at the point in the book of Bamidbar when the Jewish people begin to conquer the land. The story that precedes Bilam is the battle against Sichon and the battle against Og, which is the beginning of the second generation, the ones who were born in the desert, begin to conquer the land in chapter 21 of Bamidbar. The first generation dies in chapter 20. Aaron dies, Miriam dies. And then the Torah asks a question, a very important question. Second generation has begun to conquer the land. The first generation dies in the desert. Question, what is the advantage of the second generation over the first? Why are they any better? It's the same people. The parents, the children. What makes us think that the second generation could be better than the first? And at that point, the Torah introduces Bilam, whose job is to curse. If Bilam can curse, that means that we're not worthy. But if somehow Bilam is forced to bless, that means that somehow we are worthy. And when you look at the curses and blessings of Bilam, something interesting. He actually blesses three times and a fourth time. And what's interesting is, this is true of biblical poetry, but that doesn't fully explain it. The theme that constantly appears in the Bilam blessings is Jacob and then Israel. And not just the words Yaakov and Yisrael, which appears eight times. But when you actually look at the blessings of Bilam, you will see that he specifically refers to the set of events that take place after Yaakov returns from the land of Aram and tries to cross over the Yabok River back into the land. He recalls specifically that event. Tamot nafshi mot yisharim uti achriti kamohu. The yisharim, the idea of Yashar, which is Yisrael, the idea of mimana afar Yaakov umisparet rova Yisrael, which I translate, who can count the dust and the seed, rova, from the word harviya, the seed of Jacob. The reference is to the particular story in the Chumash when Jacob leaves the house of Lavan and wants to cross over the Yabok River, the river of struggle. If he crosses over, he assumes the covenantal blessing, but he can't cross. Everybody else can cross, but Jacob cannot cross. He's left to levado. He's alone. He's badad. He's alone. Another theme that Bilam picks up on. Right? Levadad yishkon uvagoyim lo yitchashav. And the Chumash there raises a question that every student who ever thought for 2 seconds asks in whoever studied the Torah, which is, what is so great about Jacob? We're not supposed to ask those questions in some places, but how can you not? What makes him worthy of becoming covenantal? He stole a blessing from his brother. He stole a birth. He manipulated his brother with the birthright. He tricks a blind father. He manipulates Lavan's flocks. Okay, maybe he's not a wicked person, but I wouldn't give him Shlisha either. You know what I mean? What's so wonderful about him? And then he comes to cross over, and he can't cross. Everybody else crosses over. Vayivater Yaakov levado, he's left alone. And then something happens. Vayeyovek ishimo adalot hashachar. He wrestles alone with this mysterious person. A person who's also God's representative. And in that battle, he becomes a different person. He's transformed into Israel. That is to say, if he remains Jacob, he never crosses. But that moment of self-transformation, he cried out to God, Hatzileni na, save me, save me. But God didn't answer Jacob. God, the only time you have in the Chumash where God didn't directly answer him. Hatzileni na miyad achi miyad, save me from my brother, from Esav. He's going to kill everybody. Eima bonim, everybody. What does God respond? There is no immediate response. Vayolen sham balayla ahu, no answer. But Jacob understands actually that there was a response. Jacob actually interprets that there was a response, because after he wrestles with this person who can't overcome him, Vayarki lo yacholo, so Jacob named the place Peniel, God's face, for he said, Ki ro'iti Elohim panim el panim, vatinatzel nafshi, my soul was saved. He understands that God did answer him. Hatzileni na. Sometimes the way you answer somebody is by not helping them. Because if you're always bailing someone out, we call it enabling, what have you gained? So sometimes you say, you have to solve this on your own. I'm not going to help you. Because I'm not really helping you by helping you. And that's what Jacob understands. Jacob confronted for the first time God's absence or God's silence. And Jacob confronted for the first time the possibility that not only Jacob would be killed, but that his people would be totally annihilated. Eima bonim, all of them, everybody, men, women, and children. And he's left alone to struggle with it. God didn't bail him out. But Jacob is able, through his own abilities, his own internal strength, to become a different person. And in becoming a different person, he crosses over to the other side. And, most importantly, what is, send me away for dawn has come, says this mysterious Ish. And what does Jacob say? Lo ashalechacha ki im berachtani, unless you bless me. I force you to bless. What is your name? Jacob. No. No longer shall be Jacob, but rather Israel. Ki sarita im Elohim v'im anoshim v'atuchal. That's what the book of Bamidbar picks up. Exactly at this transitional moment. The Chumash asked the question that the Chumash is asking with Yaakov. What makes him worthy of moving forward? And the Chumash gives the same answer in the prophecies of Bilam that it gives in the story of Jacob, which is your ability to change yourself, your ability to transform yourself, even in a place where God is absent, even in the desert, even in the place where God is absent, even the Yabok, even when you're alone, you're able to transform yourself, and therefore you can force the other to bless you, and you can move forward. What's interesting is, I'll give you another example of how important the Bilam story is. It's interesting, those who study the book of Shmuel, so of course, another awesome book, I would say. I would say the writer of Shmuel and the writer of the Megillah are twins. I don't mean literally. They're joined at the hip. They have exactly the same. Two awesome. Exactly seeing the world. The cynicism is there. But it's such an amazing book. Samuel the prophet, of course, appears in the first half of the first book of Shmuel. He dies, who knows when, chapter 25. But he speaks, he's a prophet, but he doesn't speak poetry. The book of Shmuel, the prophet Samuel speaks prose, except in one place. There's one place where he speaks poetry. Now, where is that place? I'll tell you where it is. It's in the story of Amalek. Story of Amalek is where he speaks poetry, and in three different places. First place is where King Saul says, I have fulfilled the word of God. I did it. I did everything right. Really? What's those animals, the noise I'm hearing? Oh, the people brought them to sacrifice. So let me tell you something, he says. You don't understand. Obedience is more important than sacrifice. And then he continues. Kichata kesem meri. The oven utrafim hafzar. Yan ma'asta dvar Hashem, vayimascha mi melech. anybody who's, that's poetry. Chata kesem meri the avenu trafim hafzar. Where's that coming from? Kesem meri. Chata kesem meri kesem the avenu trafim hafzar. He's picking up on the second prophecy of Bilam. Ki lo nachash b'Yakov lo kesem b'Yisrael. Lo he beat oven b'Yakov lo ra'amal b'Yisrael. He picks one of the two phrases of each. And he says, Bilam had said you can move forward because there's no oven and there's no kesem and there's no nachash. And Shmuel says to Saul, king of Israel, but no. Ki chatat kesem meri. Your sin is your meri is kesem. Samim, witchcraft. The oven, trafim, and oven, iniquity, and trafim, and trafim, and idolatry is your refusal. And then we have another statement. At the end of the story, he goes back with Saul, King Shaul, and he, as he's walking away from Saul, first he kills Agag. He says to Agag, Kasher shikla nashim charbecha kein nishgal mi nashim imecha. Clearly biblical poetry, exactly poetic, and chiastic structure as well. But the third place is when he walks away from Saul, and Saul apparently reaches out and he tears his garment. So Shmuel says to Shaul, he says, God has torn the kingship away from you. And given it to your friend who is better than you. And the eternal one of Israel will not change his mind. Now, without getting into the depths of it, I'll make a simple point. That statement is lifted straight from the Chumash. The second prophecy of Bilam, how does it start? Lo ish el vi nachem uven adam vi, right? Lo ish el vi chazei uven adam vi yitnecham. God is not a human being who disappoints. God is not a human being who changes God's mind. Right? What's interesting is, even the verse, he says to, God has torn away the kingship from you and given it to the reyacha hatov mimecha. Let me explain what it means in 2 minutes. I'll explain it and wrap it up. It's like this. Reacha, in the Chumash, in Bilam's prophecy, it says there is no divination, and there is no nachash, and no oven, and no amal, but rather, Hashem Elokav Imo, Utruat Melech Bo. Lord God is with him, Utruat Melech Bo. What does it mean, Utruat Melech Bo? So what's interesting is, Trua usually is a cry. The cry of the king is within him. Within the camp of Israel is the Trua of a king. Interesting is Rashi. What does Rashi say? Truat melech bo, says Rashi two words, Lashon Re'ut, the friendship of a king. And the truth is, if you know the piyutim of Rosh Hashanah, the piyutim of Rosh Hashanah plays with Trua in terms of friendship. But I'll tell you the truth, before you get to the piyutim, and before you get to Rashi, a much greater interpreter than Rashi. I don't know his name. So whoever wrote the book of Shmuel is the greatest. And that's how he understood it. Truat melech bo. And God has torn the kingship away from you, Saul, and given it to a king who's great, better than you. Reacha hatov mimecha. That is to say, because the true king is God, says Samuel. But you don't represent God in this world. Because the representative of God can't have nachash, it can't have kesem, it can't have oven, it can't have amal. And you have all of those things. And therefore, we tear away the kingship from you and give it to somebody else. Samuel is using Bilam's prophecies, but in a different way. And that is, the prophecy of Bilam and the story of Jacob, upon which it's based, is taking place at a transitional point in time. It's about the ability to move forward. But in the case of Samuel, of course, he uses it exactly the opposite way, as he often does, the Shmuel writer, which is, we transition out of you. Because the true king of Israel can't be one who doesn't reflect God's kingship. The true king of Israel must reflect God's true values. Basically, that's what Chana says at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. It's doing God's work in this world. If you don't, then we transition away from you. which I'm sure is playing off, utruat melech bo. So there you see, what's the point? You see that this is not just a story, it's a pivotal moment in time. So the writer of the Bilam story is connected, one might say there's a web of three stories. There's the story of Jacob wrestling with the Ish, there's the story of Bilam, there's the story of Saul and David at that critical moment. The writer of the Megillah sees all these things and actually uses both the Jacob story and the Bilam story in most interesting ways, which I unfortunately don't have time to fully explain or explain at all, actually. I'll say one last word, though. Give me 1 minute, I'll say one last word. When you read the Megillah, you're always thinking of these other texts because the Megillah must be read in by itself in its own right. It has its own meaning. But there are all kinds of allusions. So that, for example, I mentioned the story of Jacob wrestling with the Ish. The Jacob wrestling with the Ish, of course, this mysterious Ish, takes place with a story within a story. The outer story is Esav and Yaakov. He's about to meet Esav. He meets Esav, but in the middle, he confronts this Ish. In the battle of the Ish against Jacob, when Jacob is alone, when God is silent, when everybody is threatened with total extinction, which of course is the story of the Megillah. It's a book about God's absence. There was no God in the Megillah. If the writer of the Megillah wanted to put God in the Megillah, God would be in the Megillah. The writer of the Megillah can do anything. Therefore, it's intentional that God is not there and everybody is threatened. And we're on our own. We're on our own. In that story, though, it's very interesting that the writer of the Megillah has referenced the story of Jacob and the Ish. Actually, in several ways. But I'll mention one of them, which is this. When Haman returned home in that very funny scene, where, of course, he's talking about himself, but he's so disappointed that Mordechai won't bow down. And then, go to the king and tell him what to do. When he goes to the king, he never gets a word in edgewise. The king tells him what to do. Maher kachat avush v'yet asus kasherim. Hurry up and do it, hurry. Another element of humor. So he's being transported all over the place. Then he comes home. And then his so-called friends become his wise men. And what do they say to him? In Mizera Hayudim Mordechai, one of the turning points. If Mordechai is from the Jewish people, Asher hachilot lepo lefanav lo tuchalo, you cannot overcome him. Ki nafol tipo lefanav. The writer of the Megillah actually includes an interesting expression, lo tuchalo, and doesn't drop that expression. It appears twice more in a very interesting phrase, where it's completely gratuitous. It's when Esther begs the king for the Jewish people. What does she say? Second time. Rescind the decrees. Ki echacha uchal v'ra'iti bara'ash ha'yintzat ami. Ki echacha uchal v'ra'iti b'yavdon moladati. When you read that verse in chapter 8 of the Megillah, the word uchal is totally superfluous. You don't need the word uchal. In fact, the verse that it plays off, which is Judah speaking to Joseph, ki eich el el aviv anare nenu iti, pener evarash, eim tzayt avi, does not have the word uchal in it. It's clear. The writer uses that verse. I don't want to talk about it maybe this afternoon, but the writer actually adds a gratuitous word twice. The word is uchal. Why? Echacha uchal v'ra'iti. How can I prevail if I see? Because the writer wants to reference the story of Jacob wrestling with the Ish, alone, without God, without God's help, in the night, threatened with complete extinction. And what does the Ish say to Jacob? Your name is Israel. Why? Ki sarita melohim v'yem anashim v'atuchal. Bayarki lo yocholo. He couldn't overcome him. Lo yocholo v'atuchal. You have prevailed. So in the Megillah story, which is a retelling of the story of Jacob and Esav, Esav being Amalek, and a retelling not just of Jacob and Amalek, Jacob and Esav, but the Ish. Supernatural enemy, who's also the natural enemy, the enemy of Israel, the enemy of God, Amalek. In that story, we are remembering Jacob's ability to overcome. Alone. And that's where Esther stands, alone. No one else can save the Jews. So Esther says, Echacha uchal, if I am to prevail, it's not about myself. I will fail unless I save everybody. Echacha uchal v'ra'iti. And that already was There's already prophesied by Haman's own family and friends, the so-called friends. If he's Mizera Ayudim lo tuchalo. Let me summarize in 30 seconds and say this. The Megillah is a very funny book. On the other hand, it's a very scary book. The two things are not actually contradictory. I think in terms of our practice of Purim, what enables us sometimes to get through life, my father used to say, most important thing is having a sense of humor. Because a sense of humor is able, in some sense, a sense of humor allows you to say all kinds of things. Under the guise of being drunk, of kidding, of joking, we can express our deepest fears and deepest truths about the world as we experience it. On the other hand, the allusions to all these other texts suggest to us that we shouldn't despair. As difficult as it is, as difficult as the situation may be, and we know it's going to continue because Amalek's in every generation. So the Megillah, the writer of this book, has chosen to write a comedy, which of course is also a great tragedy and deals with the reality of our lives. I think I've just scratched the surface over here, but I think this is plenty to think about. Anyway, thank you. Yeah.